Welcome to the Earth First Update. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on Thursday, March 2nd. Want to ask you to have a pencil and paper, or maybe even your screen available, so that you can take notes on names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, any information you need to take action. Let's start off with announcements. The 2017 Earth First Roadshow is going to be getting started. Greetings to all rabble-rousers, water protectors, land defenders, anti-fascists, and resistance fighters. In light of all the insanity that is our present political climate, a group of Earth Firsters are excited to announce the 2017 Earth First Roadshow. We'll be hitting the road and planning a two-month cross-country roadshow that will end at the Round River Rendezvous in Northern California in early July. We want to nurture the inspiring seeds of dissidents, learn about and support various cross-country struggles, connect people and places to a political platform of opposing Trump and all the white supremacy, eco-terror, and rage he instills. Beginning in late April, we'll be kicking off our tour in South Florida, and we aim to plan a route that coincides with several action camps and conferences throughout the country. Dates and places will be announced. You want to have the roadshow visit you? Let them know. Small and rural towns will be given priority as we hash out dates and times. Get in touch with our collective to receive a list of skill shares and workshops we can offer, in addition to a short presentation promoting biocentrism within a cross-struggle framework. For all that is wild and toward a more free world, your friendly 2017 Earth First Roadshow crew. For booking, questions, and comments, email earthfirstroadshow2017@riseup.net. That's earthfirstroadshow2017@riseup.net. Or you can go to earthfirstroadshow17.wordpress.com for tour update. And today was the day that marked the 20th anniversary of the death of Judy Berry, Earth First activist and organizer for Redwood Summer. Judy Berry and Daryl Cherney were blown up in a car in Oakland, and she lived with cancer after that until her death on March 2nd, 1997. And the California Native Plant Society Habitat Restoration Team is having a restoration this Saturday, March 4th, at 10 a.m. in Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. Linda writes, "With this warm, sunny weather, we can feel and see footsteps of spring coming our way. We will continue our broom bash efforts, removing invasive non-native French broom in the Oakwoodland areas of Quail Hollow. We'll see you there. To get to Quail Hollow, go north on Graham Hill Road from Santa Cruz. As you come down into Felton, turn right at the light and go up East Diante Road for 2 miles. Turn left on Quail Hollow Road, and a half mile up on the right is the park entrance. They will meet you at the gravel parking lot on the left-hand side of the road. Once again, that's this Saturday, March 4th at 10 a.m., Quail Hollow Ranch County Park. If you need to contact Linda, her email address is redwoodrn, that's R-E-D-W-D-R-N, at pacbell.net. And turning to direct action news, this news from the front lines as found in Bite Back. During the night of 17th and 18th of February 2017, 19 hunting towers were neutralized in the forest of Compiègne-Oise, France. The shooting hunters, dog hunters, and the NFB, I'm not sure what that is, are jointly responsible for the destruction of nature and the mass murder of animals. The regulation of nature is only a crude decoy to hide the barbarism of this pastime and the purely mercantile interests of the NFB. Some associations that defend them, like the AFLOC and Oise Nature, are complicit in the same crimes. It is the work of civilization to stop them. Let's roll up our sleeves, signed ALF-60. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign update for this week. Yellowstone and Montana are close to reaching their shameful goal of killing 1,300 of America's last wild buffalo. Nearly 700 buffalo have been caught this winter, with close to 500 having already been sent to slaughter. Additionally, over 400 buffalo have been shot and killed by hunters along Yellowstone's boundaries, Winter will also take a heavy toll on hundreds more buffalo this year, which the responsible agencies fail to consider as they kill to placate cattle industry politics and prejudice. Yellowstone blames Montana. Montana passes the buck back to Yellowstone. Both are guilty of the crimes being committed against the beloved Yellowstone herds, our national mammal. Neither party takes responsibility for their actions, yet they are both accountable, and they both have the power to stop the slaughter that has been taking place for far too long. Please take immediate action by contacting Yellowstone National Park at area code 307-344-2002. That telephone number again, 307-344-2002, and demand that they stand up to Montana's livestock industry and represent the sacred buffalo who should be under their protection. Also call Montana Governor Steve Bullock, his number, area code 406-444-3111. That number again, 406-444-3111, to insist that he listen to the majority of Montanans, Americans, and people around the world who support wild migratory buffalo freely roaming outside Yellowstone National Park. Urge him to repeal MCA 81-2-120 to end livestock control over wild bison and endorse a plan that respects wild buffalo like wild elk in Montana. Do not let them pass the buck. Yellowstone and Montana both have the power to change the status quo to benefit wild buffalo. Let's ensure that they do this. Make the calls and join us on the front lines so that the slaughter, negligence, and disrespect come to an end once and for all. Yesterday, due to pressure from a public access lawsuit filed last year by the Animal Legal Defense Fund on behalf of Buffalo Field Campaign's media coordinator, Yellowstone National Park held one of two escorted media tours of their infamous Stevens Creek buffalo trap, where this year alone nearly 700 wild buffalo have been captured for slaughter. Buffalo Field Campaign was present for the tour, along with one local paper, an independent photojournalist, and other bison advocates. Yellowstone granted us a guarded glimpse of more than 60 buffalo were brutally run through Yellowstone's squeeze chute and pushed into sorting pens, where they will spend the night before their fatal trip to the slaughterhouse. Yellowstone wranglers on horseback haze buffalo from the trap's outer catch pens into fortified wooden corrals, where they poked and prodded with electric sticks and noisy rattles as humans yelled and forced them into tighter spaces where they would, one by one, be funneled through the silencer, Yellowstone's squeeze chute. Interestingly, the silencer label has been covered up with paint and is no longer visible. This contraption is a nightmare for wild bison. It's where biologists draw their blood, check the buffalo's teeth, and weigh them in before sending them into the dark corridors into sorting pens. Many buffalo are injured and all are separated from their family groups. As each buffalo was forced into the squeeze chute, he or she would run forwards, then backwards, then forwards again, bucking, jumping, and kicking, doing whatever they thought they could to try and escape the jaws. Often, as Yellowstone's wranglers closed the headgate to the squeeze chute, their timing would be off and they would clamp down hard on soft bellies or the soft horns of yearling buffalo, breaking them off and inflicting trauma and intense pain. One by one, the buffalo were forced to endure these and other horrors, and each buffalo fought with every ounce of strength they had. The sounds of their banging against cold metal we will not forget. Even worse were the brief moments we were escorted by law enforcement onto the catwalks overlooking a sorting pen. Although they tortured nearly 65 buffalo yesterday, they only allowed us to view one pen holding about 15 yearlings. It was a bitter and gruesome sight. Bloodied babies that had been separated from their mothers were ramming each other, panting, panicked, and looking at us as if pleading, "Who are you? Where's my mother? Why am I here? Why are you just standing there crying? Let me out." By bearing witness to these atrocities, and we gathered the evidence for countless court cases, representing wild buffalo from a place of experience in the policy arena, informing the media and other decision makers as to the truth of bison management. Each of these things has forced changes, both subtle and profound, in the landscape to benefit of wild buffalo. Most importantly, we share everything we witness with you, inspiring action. For we cannot do this alone. We need you to see these things, to share them with everyone you know, to tell the story of the last wild buffalo and rise up to take real, meaningful action. These horrors must end. Each and every action against the buffalo must give rise to resistance. You can go to the Buffalo Field Campaign webpage. That's buffalofieldcampaign.org, where you can find this information and plenty more. Once again, that webpage, www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. And Cascadia Wildlands has been going to federal court to stand up for Oregon wolves and wildlands. Cascadia Wildlands continues to defend the bioregion's wild ecosystems in federal district courts in the face of ongoing threats. On February 16th, represented by the Western Environmental Law Center, we and our conservation partners had oral arguments challenging the authority of the notorious federal agency Wildlife Services to kill gray wolves in Oregon. A decision is expected in the next few months. We'll be back in federal court in Eugene tomorrow, March 3rd, challenging the Umpqua National Forest Loafer Project, which proposes to log over 800 acres of high-elevation forest near Crater Lake National Park. The timber sale is cherished landscape on the Umpqua National Forest, encompassing the Umpqua Hot Springs, the Dread and Terror Ridge area, and will downgrade northern spotted owl habitat, impact recreation and scenic resources, and employ controversial logging techniques to create elk foraging habitat out of mature forest. An ongoing action is needed to help the Elliott State Forest stay public. Since voting to privatize the 83,000-acre Elliott State Forest on the Oregon Coast Range on February 14th, newly elected Democratic Treasurer Tobias Reed has heard from thousands of Oregonians renouncing his vote and telling him to keep the Elliott public. Thank you for taking action. Let's keep up the chorus. Call his office today with the simple message of keep the Elliott State Forest in public ownership. That number, 503-378-4329. Once again, the telephone number for Democratic Treasurer Tobias Reed is area code 503-378-4329. Ironically, Treasurer Reed is part of Oregon's leadership calling to host Outdoor Retailer, the massive outdoor industry show that recently withdrew from hosting the events in Utah over that state's stance opposing the protection of public lands. A great way for Treasurer Reed to court this economy-boosting trade event is to walk his walk and talk his talk, withdraw his support for privatizing the Elliott State Forest. The grassroots have been hard at work to keep the Elliott public as well. On February 23rd, Cascadia Wildlands helped facilitate Elliott Lobby Day, which turned out over 100 Oregonians who met with their elected officials in Salem, Oregon, to educate them about the Elliott situation and the need to keep the Elliott State Forest public. And Cascadia Wildlands has intervened in a case seeking to remove protections for gray wolves in California. Cascadia Wildlands and partners intend to intervene in the Pacific Legal Foundation's case challenging California's recent listing of the gray wolf as an endangered species. Cascadia Wildlands was part of a coalition that filed a successful 2012 petition to list the species as endangered in the state of California and are eager to intervene against the claim alleged by the plaintiffs that wolves are not native to California. By doing so, we will continue to stand up for the state's budding wolf population, which currently consists of the lone Shasta pack, whose territory lies close to the namesake volcano near the Oregon border. In this story from Alaska, the Cook Inlet natural gas leak can't be fixed until the ice melts, the company says. Citing a potential oil leak and dangers to its employees, Hillcorp says leaking pipeline can't be shut down or fixed while many fear for the inlet's beluga whales. In this story written by Sabrina Shankman of Inside Climate News. The company responsible for an ongoing natural gas pipeline leak in Cook Inlet, Alaska, said it won't be able to attempt to repair it until the ice melts, which will be later this month at the earliest. The aging pipeline has been releasing natural gas into a critical habitat for the endangered Cook Inlet beluga whales since at least February 7th. Hillcorp Alaska, a subsidiary of Houston-based Hillcorp, owns the 8-inch underwater pipeline that transports natural gas from shore to four offshore oil platforms, also owned by Hillcorp. In a letter to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation on February 12th, the company said it would not be able to safely shut down or repair the pipeline until ice in the inlet recedes. Given the typical weather patterns affecting ice formation and dissipation in Cook Inlet, we currently anticipate that the earliest the conditions will allow diving will be mid to late March, wrote David Wilkins, Senior Vice President of Hillcorp Alaska. An estimated 210 to 310,000 cubic feet of natural gas are leaking into the inlet each day. The Alaska Department of Environment Conservation responded on Monday, noting that Hillcorp did not respond to its request for a plan monitoring the leak and any environmental impacts. Without that data, the state says it can't assess the extent of the threat to Cook Inlet. The state cannot determine acceptable environmental conditions without first having characterized the release, wrote State On-Scene Coordinator Jeff Merrill. Therefore, it is imperative that Hillcorp begin a sampling and monitoring program. The state has now asked Hillcorp to provide that plan by March 8th, which it will then have to approve before Hillcorp begins the monitoring. By then, the gas will have been leaking for more than a month. Hillcorp did not respond to requests for comments. Bob Shavelson of nonprofit Cook Inlet Keeper called the state's response tepid. He has urged the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration to step in and shut the pipeline down, something PHMSA has the authority to do, but which the state has not requested. The cause of the leak and the date it started are unknown. It was first noticed by an occupant of a helicopter who saw the gas bubbling up as passengers flew over the inlet between the town of Nikiski and one of Hillcorp's platforms. Since then, the company and a bevy of state and federal agencies have been thwarted by persistent ice in the region in trying to assess the damage. Weather permitting, Hillcorp flies over the leak daily, according to the most recent situation report released by the state. Most days, ice cover makes it impossible to see the source. Shavelson and others are concerned that the methane in the gas could displace oxygen in the water, causing a hypoxic zone, which could be dangerous for the estimated 340 beluga whales in Cook Inlet. These belugas were listed as endangered under the Endangered Species Act in 2008. 3 years later, the National Marine Fisheries Service designated some areas of the inlet, including the location of the gas leak, as critical habitat for belugas under the Endangered Species Act. In its letter to the Department of Environmental Conservation, Hillcorp said the amount of dissolved methane in the bubbles coming up from the leak is likely minimal, and that dissolved methane is not toxic to aquatic organisms. The company also noted that although beluga whales are in the area of the leak, they also avoid the ice cover. The subtext is that since the area above the leak is covered in ice, the belugas will be less likely to be in that area. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have disputed that claim in a February 24th letter to PHMSA. The agency said, Cook Inlet belugas have shown a preference for ice cover. When ice was present, tagged whales were more likely to be associated with it. In a significant hypoxic zone created by a continuing natural gas discharge, NOAA said, Cook Inlet belugas and multiple physical and biological features of their critical habitat could be adversely affected. The Center for Biological Diversity, a conservation group, sent a letter to the Environmental Protection Agency and Hillcorp this week detailing the potential threat to species in the Cook Inlet and giving them notice that if the problem is not remediated within 60 days, the center intends to sue Hillcorp. This is the second notice of intent to sue. The first was issued by Cook Inlet Keeper on February 15th. Hillcorp has said that it cannot shut the pipeline down without risking a potentially more dangerous leak of crude oil. Before it became a supply line that brings natural gas to the oil platforms, the pipeline carried crude. If the flow of natural gas were stopped, the company said the pipeline would fill with seawater and potentially cause the line to leak residual crude. The company also wrote in its February 20th letter to the DEC that shutting down the line would pose safety risks for Hillcorp personnel and the environment, in part because without natural gas to power the platforms, they would have to ship diesel in. That would mean treacherous navigation through dark, cold, icy, and strong water currents. The whole thing about moving diesel out to the platforms posing a big risk is overblown, said one person who has worked in oil and gas production and spill response. Requesting anonymity because he occasionally works with Hillcorp, he said they move diesel through to those platforms all the time. To make that seem like it is unusual risk is disingenuous. He also said he believes the risk of crude oil leaking out is minimal, though it could happen. It is unlikely to be large amounts of crude, the individual said. though any sheen on the surface of Cook Inlet would be bad publicity for the company. Hilcorp buys oil and gas operations that are already producing in hopes of earning any remaining profits. It has become the primary producer in Cook Inlet using this strategy. According to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, the company is responsible for more than a quarter of all 45 safety violations from 1977 through 2016. The company began operating in Alaska in 2012. The commission has said that disregard for regulatory compliance is endemic to Hilcorp's approach to its Alaskan operations. Hilcorp has proposed to develop a project off Alaska's Beaufort Sea coast in the Arctic Ocean, which would entail building a gravel island 5 miles offshore and drilling new wells instead of inheriting existing ones. The project falls within the 2.8 million acre region of the Beaufort Sea that was not made off limits by President Barack Obama's ban on drilling in many parts of the U.S. Arctic in December. The company said it would have to operate a pipeline to transfer oil between the Gravel Island and the mainland and in a much more remote location than Cook Inlet. Lois Epstein, a licensed engineer who is the Arctic Program Director for the Wilderness Society, raised the issue of Hilcorp's Arctic plans. If responding to a leak in an icy inlet is impossible, what does that imply for operations in icier Arctic waters? She asked, what if this leak was oil? And Amazonia's indigenous communities affected by oil spills have reached agreement with Peru. In this story by Segundo Chiquipiondo of Intercontinental Cry. In 2016, the presence of oil in the Amazonian region marked a before and after in the environment history of Peru. The basins of the Marañón River in the Amazonas region and the Morona River in the Loreto region have been left exposed to an imminent danger of contamination, along with a large number of indigenous communities who depend upon their waters. September 1st of last year, more than 70 communities located in 5 Amazonian basins, the Tigre, Marañón, Pastaza, Corrientes, and Chimbira, blocked the Marañón River in a protest for constant spills caused by leaks in the North Peruvian pipeline and closed river traffic to oil-transporting vessels, along with other commercial vessels, while the government of President Pablo Kuczynski ignored the situation. According to the Environment Assessment and Control Agency, 13 oil spills occurred in 2016 alone, dumping thousands of barrels of oil into the waterways. Environment authorities put the blame for the spills on the deteriorated North Peruvian pipeline, owned by Peru's state-run oil company, Petroperú. Constructed in the 1970s, the pipeline transports the oil extracted from the Peruvian Amazonian region from Station 1 in San Jose de Somuro near Loreto along 854 kilometers, a little over 500 miles, to the Bolivar Terminal on the northern coast of Peru. Although many specialists and the OEFA have confirmed the lack of maintenance to the pipeline, Petroperú has maintained that the spills were caused by vandalism perpetrated by unscrupulous people and also by natural causes such as lightning hitting the pipeline. According to anthropologist Federica Barclay, the history of oil activity in the region started in the 70s during the military government and with the approval of an oil law meant to stimulate its exploitation. However, it lacked the proper environmental regulation and it was not paired with legislation aimed at defending indigenous rights. Did anyone by any chance ask the communities if they wanted pipes to cross their territories? Asked lawyer Henry Cuartarco, president of the Institute for the Legal Defense of the Environment and Sustainable Development in Latin America Press. Let me give you an example. All of us in Lima know that the water tubes have to be replaced every so often to prevent the accumulation of sediment in the pipes. However, imagine what the condition of the pipes that transport the oil for so many kilometers above the ground is, pipes that should have been given proper maintenance for the last 43 years. It is not obvious that they are at a point of collapsing. What is more important, to lose money or lose the lives of hundreds of indigenous peoples? The spills are proof that the state overlooks irresponsible extractive activity, and on top of that, it does so in a way that discriminates against the indigenous populations because it does not recognize their rights to reap the benefits on the easements on their land. And Wilderness Watch is appealing a ruling on Olympic structures. Wilderness Watch is appealing a district court decision that, in a marked departure from prior case law, has allowed the National Park Service to rebuild structures in the Olympic Wilderness in Washington without public notice and in direct violation of the Wilderness Act. In October of 2015, Wilderness Watch filed a suit to stop the building boom in the Olympic Wilderness. A decade earlier, a federal judge had ruled against the agency's decision to replace two collapsed shelters there. The Olympic Wilderness makes up 95% of the Olympic National Park. Wilderness Watch is urging the National Park Service to continue its hands-off management of the breach created by Hurricane Sandy in the Fire Island Wilderness in New York. Wilderness Watch is opposing a drastic tree clearing project by the Bureau of Land Management that has proposed across 47,000 acres in the Big Jacks, Little Jacks, North Fork of the Owyhee River, and Pole Creek Wildernesses in southwestern Idaho. Wilderness Watch is objecting to Forest Service plans to increase commercial outfitting and guiding in the Passaitan and Lake Chelan Sawtooth Wildernesses in Washington, increases that are certain to degrade wilderness conditions in those areas. And for more information, go to wildernesswatch.org. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is produced every Thursday evening right here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. You can hear a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon, that is Friday at 3 p.m. In North Adams, Massachusetts, listen to WNMB 107.1 Fridays at 5:30 a.m. Or in Moscow, Idaho, listen to KRFP 90.3 Wednesdays at 3 p.m. In Dade City, Florida, listen to WLSL 92.7 Sundays at noon. You can go online to the Grateful Dread Public Radio, gdprnashville.org. Once again, gdprnashville.org, Sundays at 2 a.m. You can tune into KGIG 104.9 in Modesto, California. But unfortunately, their program schedule doesn't list the time the Earth First Update is broadcast. You can listen to Berkeley Liberation Radio at 104.1, where they broadcast the Earth First Update sometimes. But you can always find the Earth First Update at radio4all.net. That's radio, the number 4all.net. Or you can listen online or download this or previous editions of the Earth First Update. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and air. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to the Earth First Update. The Earth First Update is produced by Earth First Radio in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.